Now, update number two, and this involves our recent show on creativity. Little did we know when we put it together just how creative one of our main guests, Jonah Lehrer, actually was. A few weeks after the program, he was embroiled in scandal and was forced to admit that he'd actually made up important facts in his new best-selling book, Imagine, The Science of Creativity. Just made them up. Imagine that. And several people tweeted taking umbrage with Edward Jung from Intellectual Ventures, another of our guests on that particular show.
Hello, this is Vivica Wiley. I'm a PhD researcher in the Creativity and Cognition Studios at the University of Technology, Sydney. And I heard your very interesting program on creativity lately. And in particular, I was interested in the words of Edward Jung from Intellectual Ventures. I work with some startup companies on putting ideas together, turning them into products. And they've heard of Intellectual Ventures, but they don't feel the way about them that perhaps Intellectual Ventures might like them to feel. They don't see them as that kind of white knight, really. He mentioned the nice side of their business, where they have 1,000, you know, researchers who've put together 1,000 patents. He didn't talk so much about the 30,000 patents they've acquired and their practice of then sending on those patents to shell companies, empty offices with no assets and very few employees, whose entire purpose is then to sue other people, other inventors who've independently come up with the same invention. So Intellectual Ventures have now become known as kind of the canonical patent troll. Somewhat ironic, as one of their four founders, Peter Detkin, actually coined the term patent troll as a pejorative while he was working at Intel. Edward Jung described creativity as this kind of process where there's a person sitting alone in a room and an idea comes to them and they give it, send it out to the world. And that's a very outmoded idea of creativity, and it's very odd, but it is a lot like the way the patent system sees creativity. I mean, as other speakers on your show mentioned, creativity is a social process. It happens within and among people. Every idea is built upon the huge substructure of other ideas. You know, as Newton said, he stood on the shoulders of giants, as do we all. So there's this social process going on, and when something is invented somewhere in the world, it's very likely that it's being simultaneously invented by other people. And then if somebody happens to register the patent and then just sits on their hands and doesn't actually do anything with it, they become able then to sue anyone who does implement the idea, and they don't have anything to lose. So there's no way to countersue them for a frivolous suit, if their patent is overbroad or obvious. This could be considered one of the motivations for setting up a company that doesn't make anything itself.
Vivica Wiley. And our final catch-up for today involves Professor Tony Fry from Griffith University in Brisbane. Almost a year ago, we spoke with Dr. Fry about his plans to develop what he calls an Urmadic university, basically a network of academics, specialists and thinkers not tied to one particular campus, but sharing their ideas to solve some of the world's pressing problems. The concept is a challenge to the current location-based, industry-specific approach taken by many tertiary institutions. So, 12 months on, let's get an update.
The purpose of the Urmadic University is pretty simple. It's to actually deal with the failures of the university that currently exist, because the current university is more or less just serving the status quo. It isn't really responding to the challenges of the future. So the Urmadic University is actually presenting the existing university with that possibility.
And in that sense, the initiative is focused on the problem, isn't it? It's not focused on the academic institution or bringing people together in an academic institution to deal with problems. It's focused on going to the problem and bringing the people to the problem. Is that correct?
Exactly. I mean, we're facing huge problems, and they are all connected. We tend to think about the problems as if they were separate. But, you know, if you bring together food, population, climate change, just to take three, those three problems are all one problem. And they all have specific contexts in particular places. And the way that we need to deal with those problems is to actually learn by going to those places and actually dealing with them, not just technically, not just scientifically, but socially and culturally as well.
Now, you kicked off the Urmadic University initiative last year with a hothouse that we covered on this program that was held in Brisbane. This year, you've held another one in Paris. And in line with that idea of going to the problem, you're looking at various places where you can actually start doing what? Demonstration models, I guess, of how you would tackle these problems.
Yes, we met in Paris. We were trying to build the constituency. We had people from 10 different countries attending. But we decided we weren't just going to go on having a talk in shop. We were actually to show people what we do by doing it. So we're starting out next year, probably going to Slovenia, one of the countries in the world that is, you know, having major economic problems. So how do you start to, on the ground, imagine and create another kind of economy? You know, Slovenia's interesting because, you know, it's just gone through this transition from communism to capitalism, and it's disillusioned with both. So there's a conversation. It's not based upon us going with expertise, which we're parachuting into the place, but rather we've made contact with people in Slovenia. So it's a dialogue where we identify and explore the problems with them.
What attracted us at Future Tense to the Urmadic University idea in the first place was its complexity. Yes. It is a difficult thing to get your head around because it is a different way of looking at what a university is and should be, how it should function. But yet you and the initiative are still connected to Griffith University here in Brisbane, Australia. Sure. How do you manage that? How do you explain the concept of the Urmadic University and that connection to, you know, a brick-and-mortar university in Griffith?
Well, first of all, we have to put it in the context of time. The project of the Urmadic University isn't a project of a few months or a few years or even a few decades. You know, it's participating in the revitalization of the existing university in the same way that the modern university is a product of the revitalization of the original medieval university by the taking in of new thinking around reason. So we're beginning a process that we will never see the end of. The current university, the modern university, is in many ways coming towards the end of its life. At the same time, it's not going away. The Urmadic University is one of those projects amongst many now in the world that are kind of committed to bringing new ways of learning in relation to pressing contemporary problems into a more dynamic relation with the existing university. So there isn't really a contradiction.
Now, you're somebody who talks a lot about the future. You're somebody who's very future-focused. How difficult is it getting people to understand the concept of the future, to understand how complex that, just that basic idea can be and what it actually entails? Because we often, it seems to me, we often think of the future almost as though it's a blank slate, as though it's a destination we're heading to. But that's not correct, is it?
No. To understand the significance of the future, you have to be able to put ourselves back into time. You have to realise that we've been around as a species, Homo sapiens, for 150,000 years. We've been settled in the forms of life that we now enjoy as they developed for around about 10,000 years. So for 150,000 years, more or less, we were nomadic. So that really tells us that the way of life that we have now isn't necessarily going to be the way of life that we're going to have in the future. We can't go on existing as we are, and we can't go on really perpetuating the status quo. Likewise, we can't go back to what we were. So on the one hand, we've got to make another future for ourselves. But as you say, we're not dealing with a blank slate. The future is already filled by a huge number of things that we've already thrown into it. It's heavily populated. The second thing is that our future as a species is not assured, partly because of what we've thrown into the future. So we are in a situation where unless we learn to occupy the planet in another way, we really don't have a very long future in terms of the length of time that we've existed in the past. So the future has to be on the agenda in a far more significant long-term way than it currently does. People talk about, you know, a few generations. We need to talk about 50 or 100 generations. So the big agenda item in relation to the future is how we learn to change.
Tony Fry, it's always interesting talking to you. Thank you very much for the update.
Thank you, Anthony. Enjoyed it again.